You're listening to the ISF Podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve sits down with leadership coach Dr. Sam Adeyemi. Sam is an expert in leadership who has coached C-suite executives for over two decades. Together, Steve and Sam explore the essence of who is a leader, and Sam explains why people should always be the first priority of a leader. They also discuss AI and how it will impact people and business in the coming years.
Sam, hello. Fantastic to have you join me on the podcast today. We're going to be talking about workplace culture, AI. Everybody wants to talk about AI, but more importantly, perhaps the role of leadership in all of that. And you're something of an expert. So you have a master's in leadership studies that you gained from University of Exeter, over where I am in the UK. You've also got a doctorate in strategic leadership that you gained from Regent University in Virginia, United States. Let's start out by defining, if we can, for people. And this may seem like an odd way to start, but let's see if we can define what is leadership.
Thank you, Steve, for having me here. From the academic viewpoint, leadership has so many definitions, but my simple definition is that leadership is the ability to influence one or more people to achieve goals or to determine outcomes.
And I think so many people talk about the role of the leader. And indeed, it always makes me smile when people tell me that they want to be a leader and that's really the goal that they're aiming for. But it's pretty hard work, isn't it?
It is. Generally, the idea is that people associate leadership with positions, especially positions in high-level positions in government and in business. So rising to the top anywhere is hard work, I should say. Again, because it's like we're all conditioned to believe that life is like a pyramid and that the higher you go up, the fewer the opportunities become, right? So you've got to really be the best of the best to rise to the top. It requires skills, requires a lot of expertise, requires for you to connect with a lot of people. It depends on the setting. If it's a democratic setting, then you even need to connect with a whole lot more people. The challenge with that, though, is once you accept that fact that leadership at the top is for a few people, the more powerless you actually feel. And that's a big challenge for me. That's why I prefer the definition of leadership that is tied to influence. Because once you bring it down to that ability to influence one or more people to achieve goals, then you realize that leadership actually happens at all levels. And if you leverage your current position, wherever you may be, to cultivate those influence skills, that actually helps you to be able to lead at higher levels. I consult with and coach executives a lot, and founders and CEOs tell me that they have a lot of people in high-level executive positions who you would consider to be leaders, but who have poor people skills, interestingly. So occupying a position at the top does not automatically therefore make you a good leader. It just gives you the opportunity to lead at a high level, right? So yes, at that high level, from my experience, usually there's a lot of competition, but it's not about skills. It's usually more of politics.
And does that vary, Sam, in your experience across culture? A lot of people, particularly in chief executives and the leadership team participants, you know, they're managing cross-cultural teams, could be across different geographies, different time zones. Any sort of advice for people in that particular area?
Yes, there are differences. There is a professor of Steed who did this research around the world, around so many countries, trying to find out the differences in leadership culture. And they found out there are actually some major differences between how leadership is done in various cultures. For example, they found out that in some cultures, you have hierarchical distance in leadership. So the people that are at the top, the people that are powerful, are very powerful, And then there's a wide gap between them and the followers. In some other cultures, that gap narrows. And this is especially in Western countries. They found out that the gap is narrow. Therefore, there's a lot more accountability. People can hold their leaders to account. People can talk to their leaders and express themselves more easily. So when we lead across cultures, we need to be sensitive to those nuances. I have a friend who is a C-level leader in the UK, is in the tech sector, and he told me that he works with people from different countries on projects. So in this particular project, he had people in the UK, he had people from Pakistan and India. So we were discussing this issue of hierarchical distance. And I said, where you have that high hierarchical distance, you tend to have a permission-seeking culture. In other words, subordinates, even when they know what to do, still tend to not use their initiative, but to wait to get permission to execute. And he said that was exactly his experience on this particular project. People from more of the developing parts of the world, Asia, Africa, he found out that even when they knew what to do, they tended to still wait for his permission before they would go ahead to do what they wanted to do. So yes, there are differences in culture, differences across cultures, and that really matters when we lead across cultures.
Now, you say that you're a people first leader. What does that actually mean in practice?
So what that means is sometimes a leader prioritizes tasks over people, and some leaders prioritize people over tasks. And I'm just trying to draw the attention of leaders to the fact that when you say leadership, it's actually people you're talking about primarily. Yes, you have systems. Yes, you have processes. Yes, you have tasks. However, the priority is people. We find out when leaders prioritize tasks over people, there's less engagement. There's less motivation. I think something happened during COVID, you know, that brought to fore the values of leaders. Because in the United States, we had what we call the Great Resignation. As we were coming out of COVID, a lot of people resigned from their jobs. And I think it had to do with the fact that leaders were feeling their ways around. Most of us had never seen anything like COVID before. The last time it happened was 100 years before. So the values of leaders came to the fore as we were making decisions. Now, that's where some people realized that their leaders actually valued profit over their lives, or valued the job, or valued power over their lives, in some cases, political power. And people realized they needed to make decisions for their own lives. So you had a lot of people making shifts in their lives as we came out of COVID. I am therefore encouraging that leaders need to put the greatest asset on people, because the human being is the most valuable asset on our planet.
It's an interesting perspective, isn't it? And I'm just curious, you mentioned COVID, that obviously drove technology really into everybody's life, in the home, to do business and so on. Is technology influencing your ability to continue to be a people first leader?
I would say, yes, it is, in the sense that now, as we came out of COVID and began to leverage the technological platforms for communicating more, leadership became a bit more impersonal. A lot of people now work remotely, and that's just a whole lot different. I know that with technology these days, especially when you see someone, you're able to talk to them, to see them, it does look like, oh, we've been seeing one another. But when you meet them face to face, you realize it's just still not the same thing. So there is that less of physical interaction. I think it matters, and leaders need to pay close attention to that, to be sure that we don't allow things to go fully impersonal. We still care about people. Leveraging technology has increased efficiency. Sometimes I have meetings back to back and they're 30 minutes each, and you're coming out of one meeting and you're going into another one. We still need to leave those spaces where we actually ask, how are you doing? To be sure those other parts of their lives that are important are going well, because those parts actually influence on what they do on the job.
In speaking for myself, I much prefer the in-person still. Technology is very convenient, as you say. It's very handy, particularly if you've got people in all sorts of different parts of the world, as I do. But I do have a little bit of a worry that technology is leading to the growth of what I would call the lazy leader. And what I mean by that is adopting technology. And so conveying all of your messages using technology in some way, shape or form, because you're just far too busy. You're far too important to be able to spend time with the people. And that is something that I think every good leader needs to be aware of and needs to put into balance. Obviously, there's going to be occasions when you have to use technology, but don't forget that they're people at the end of the day. And it is actually the strongest component, I believe, still in any organization.
I agree with you, absolutely, Steve. That face-to-face interaction is, I think, it's still difficult to replicate, right? But the big issue is prioritizing people. That's the real big issue. Some reports suggest that people became more productive working from home, in the sense somehow they were able to attend to their personal lives, take care of the kids and things like that, while still attending to work. That's fine. However, when it comes to the interaction of the leader with the people that they lead, I think we've been robbed of something there. And we need to find a way to balance it. I think we can do some things, still schedule times to interact, to meet. I think so. I think also I observe generally that a lot of leaders have pulled their staff back into the office. And I think that just attests to the fact that it's been difficult to replicate meeting people one-on-one.
Yeah, I think you learn so much more. Think back to when I first started out. If I had been working remotely, I don't think I would have picked up anywhere near the kind of experience that I did just from watching, from observing, from rubbing shoulders, not necessarily with the leadership of the organization, but just with colleagues and seeing how people got it right and, of course, sometimes got it wrong. And that sort of experiential learning is so important.
Yeah, I agree. It's like when we talk about knowledge transfer within an organization, we say that part of the knowledge is explicit knowledge, and then you have tacit knowledge. The explicit one, straightforward, can be documented. However, the tacit one is the one that has nuances, right? It's like, I originally trained as a civil engineer, so I worked on the construction site. And yes, some things were straightforward, but there were some other things that were unpredictable on the site. And then that was where the experience or the level of experience of the engineer or supervisor came to fore. Now, I had supervisors that reported to me, but who had been in the construction business much longer than I, right? They were much more experienced. I just came out of the university. I just came out of school.
Right.
So I knew more than they did on the theory. But when it came to the practical, when we came across an issue, the supervisor would say, okay, I remember this when we were on this particular site, we came across something like this, and this is how we dealt with it. Okay, let's try this. That is very difficult to replicate.
Mm.
So as I hear you, that's what comes to my mind, that a lot of that tacit knowledge, day-to-day, things that you get from interaction with people, may be lost when we leverage only on technology.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it takes us on to the whole topic of AI that I wanted to talk to you about, because so many businesses these days, of course, are seeing that as being a way of moving forward, sometimes with associated loss of people-based resources. But you've spoken about how AI can benefit businesses, and I was struck by that you've called AI the equivalent of having a little person on your shoulder. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so Elon Musk says that with time, he sees practically everybody owning a robot, because he says we'll be able to teach the robots what we do. And then they'll take, especially the routinous jobs, they'll take those away from us. So he envisages there's coming a time we'll have like 20 billion of those robots around. And the big question then is, okay, how does that work for an organization or for a business? Yes, So AI is going to take the routinous part of those jobs because it thinks like it's been developed to think like a human, right? And it does the job faster. If you're a lawyer, AI walks through cases much faster than a human being could and delivers the result. In medicine right now, AI is doing a better job than humans when it comes to surgery because of the precision with which it can go in there, invade, cut whatever it needs to cut, clean it up, and come out anyway. So we ask, okay, what's the downside? What could be the downside to that? I was listening to an interview between Farid Zakaria on CNN and the CEO of NVIDIA, the corporation that produces chips. I was really, really interested because Farid was asking the CEO about the potential downside. Oh, they say we're going to lose millions of jobs. You know, people are going to lose their jobs. However, the CEO of the NVIDIA group said, look, currently in the tech sector, they say we have 30 to 40 million positions that are not being occupied worldwide. Don't you think that if the robots take up those jobs, that will help us to be more productive, actually? So he says, I don't think that the robots are going to take the jobs away. I think they are going to change how we do the jobs. So he said, the only potential problem I see is when we humans stop creating ideas. He said, as long as we can create new ideas to improve life, to improve our world, we will continue to have more work to do. The robots will take the routinous part. However, the creative part of the job, that will be more of what we will have to do. That's the way I see it, actually, that it's like when the computers first came in, they made things work faster. When I was doing mathematics in high school, we used to use log tables and things like that. It was much slower getting to work through the calculations. But with these calculators these days and so on, it's faster. So AI is going to create even a bigger shift than that. The computers did not take all the jobs away. However, they changed the way that we did our work or we do our work. So we humans therefore need to move more towards creativity, and that is tied more to our uniqueness, the unique way our minds work, our talents and our gifts. We need to tend more towards those areas because those would be the areas that AI will find difficult to replicate. That's how I see it.
It's interesting you talk about log tables. I'd forgotten they even existed. I used to hate log tables. Absolutely hated them. Maths, I really could not come to terms with maths. So I remember when I first got a calculator, it was as if I was in heaven and that I was suddenly evil, didn't have to worry about trying to figure these things out. And so it's a good way, actually, of looking at AI and the different advances and the ways in which it's going to affect us going forward. Because you're right, it's simply an evolution, a technological evolution that we're going through. And I think if we can view it that way, then that's probably something to look forward to rather than to fear. I wanted to ask you, though, about leadership within this whole space around AI, because there is a lot of fear out there. You've worked with executives for many years now. Where do you see most C-suite leaders falling short, perhaps, on the challenges offered by AI and other emerging technologies? Where are they getting it wrong? And of course, where are they getting it right?
I think it's basically the problem with successful people that we lose our flexibility with time, especially when you've been successful. A lot of C-suite leaders find it difficult to reinvent. And it's one of the major reasons why people get stranded, why leaders just stagnate. Change is inevitable. It happens. The world doesn't remain the same. The conditions that facilitated our achievement of success, those conditions have changed. The context has changed. So for us to sustain our success, for us to remain relevant, for example, we also have just got to change. Now, that's difficult for some leaders. I read an article that was written by two professors at Harvard in the Harvard Business Review. And I read something that jolted me. Because they said many leaders find it difficult to build on their success because they are unwilling to cannibalize their success. Now, that hit me hard because I was wondering why you would put such a negative word together with a positive word, cannibalize and success.
Right.
And I know what it means to cannibalize. If maybe a vehicle, you want to scrap a vehicle, right? But then there are still some parts of it that are good. You take those out and you use them to build the new. I read 10X is easier than 2X by Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy. And they said if you want to experience big shifts, apply the Pareto principle. 20% of what you're doing is giving you 80% of your results. To make those big shifts, they suggested you kill the 80% that is giving you only 20% of your results. But they identified that it is usually emotionally difficult, psychologically difficult. That sentimental attachment to old clients, letting go of 80% of your clients, keeping the 20%, giving you most of your results, letting go of processes, letting go of even employees or staff. I think that's where we get stuck. That's where we may have challenges too with AI. The way we've always done it, that we're used to, that gave us the results we got, we've got to let them go.
And what do we replace them with, Sam? How do you get the courage, if you like, to follow through on some of the things you've just been talking about?
I think at this point that we need a very strong support group. So I think growth is usually possible with a lot of accountability. This is the idea. You take the 20% of what you do that gives you 80% of your results and then multiply that 5 times to make your new 100, right? So the truth is you're making a journey into uncertainty. When you're doing that kind of a thing, you need to have your, what we call maybe your mastermind group, people who are close to you. And that's where maybe having a coach, having mentors, that's where that becomes really helpful so that you can at least be sure you're getting some 360-degree perspective on what's going on. Because sometimes you're likely to even doubt yourself.
So we've come full circle back to where we started. People seem to be the key to everything. Sam, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks for exploring some of those areas with me today on the podcast. We could go into a whole pile of different areas, I know, but time is short. So thank you so much indeed for sharing.
Well, thank you, Steve, for having me.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Sam Adeyemi. We'll be back with another new episode next week. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. And we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become an ISF member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.